Before we dive in today, I want to let you know this episode is entirely AI-generated, including the voices you're hearing. We're brought to you by Relationship Sync Pro, a fictional app that tracks emotional compatibility in real time. And as always, please fact-check anything important since some details might be off. I'm Maya, and today we're exploring one of the most challenging books about relationships I've ever encountered. We're discussing Esther Perel's The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. I'm joined by David Chen, a relationship therapist who's been working with couples for over 15 years. David, you've been using Perel's approach in your practice since this book came out.
That's right, Maya. This book completely shifted how I work with couples dealing with infidelity. Before Perel, most therapeutic approaches were pretty binary about affairs.
What do you mean by binary?
Well, the prevailing wisdom was either affairs destroy marriages, period, or affairs are symptoms of bad marriages. Perel argued that both of those frameworks miss something crucial.
And what's that crucial thing?
That infidelity is paradoxically both a betrayal of the relationship and sometimes an expression of longing within it. She argues that people don't necessarily cheat because their relationship is broken.
That's counterintuitive. What led Perel to this conclusion?
She's a couples therapist who's worked with thousands of people across different cultures. What she noticed was that even people in happy marriages sometimes have affairs.
So what problem was she trying to solve with this book?
The problem that our cultural conversation about infidelity was too simplistic for the reality she was seeing in her office. People were getting stuck because they couldn't make sense of their experiences.
Can you give me an example of what you mean?
Sure. Perel describes couples where the betrayed partner keeps asking, "Why did you do this to us?" And the unfaithful partner answers, "I don't know." Both responses made sense under the old framework, but didn't help anyone heal.
The book exists because people needed a new way to think about infidelity?
Exactly. Perel wanted to give people language and concepts that match the complexity of what they were actually experiencing.
What makes Perel qualified to tackle such a charged topic?
She's Belgian-born, but practices in New York, so she brings both European and American perspectives. She speaks 9 languages and has worked with couples from vastly different cultural backgrounds.
That international perspective seems important for a book about infidelity.
It is. Different cultures have different assumptions about marriage, fidelity, and what constitutes betrayal. That breadth of experience informed her more nuanced approach.
Let's get into the central thesis. What's Perel's main argument about affairs?
Her core claim is that infidelity has as much to do with longing and loss as it does with sex and marriage. She argues that affairs are often about the search for a new self rather than a new partner.
What does she mean by search for a new self?
Perel noticed that people often describe their affairs as feeling like they became someone else. Someone more confident, more alive, more playful. The affair wasn't just about the other person.
So it's not primarily about dissatisfaction with one's spouse?
Not always. Perel distinguishes between affairs that happen because a marriage is dead and affairs that happen because someone feels dead inside their own life.
That's a significant distinction. How does she support this argument?
She draws on decades of clinical work, but also on literature, philosophy, and cross-cultural research. She shows how different societies have handled the tension between security and adventure in relationships.
What's the tension between security and adventure?
Perel argues that we expect modern marriage to provide both absolute security and constant novelty. We want our partner to be our best friend, passionate lover, co-parent, and business partner.
And she thinks that's unrealistic?
She thinks it creates impossible pressure. Historically, people got security from marriage and adventure elsewhere. Now we expect it all from one person.
How does this relate to infidelity specifically?
Affairs often represent an attempt to access the adventure side when the security side has taken over completely. It's not that the marriage is bad, it's that it's become too predictable.
What intellectual tradition is Perel responding to?
She's pushing back against both traditional moralistic approaches and purely psychological ones. The moralistic approach says affairs are always wrong, period. The psychological approach pathologizes them.
What does she mean by pathologizing?
treating infidelity as a symptom of addiction, trauma, or personality disorder, rather than as a complex human behavior that might have multiple meanings.
So her approach is different from both?
Right. She takes what she calls a dual perspective. She acknowledges the profound damage affairs cause while also exploring what they might reveal about human needs and relationships.
That sounds like walking a tightrope.
It is. She's constantly balancing validation of pain with curiosity about meaning. That's what makes the book so challenging and so useful.
Let's talk about her specific methods. What are the main frameworks she offers?
The first major framework is what she calls the victim versus explorer dynamic. After an affair is discovered, couples get stuck in these rigid roles.
What do those roles look like in practice?
The betrayed partner becomes the victim who asks questions and demands answers. The unfaithful partner becomes the one being interrogated. Both people get trapped in these positions.
How does that trap them?
The victim can never get enough information to feel safe again. The explorer can never give enough details to earn forgiveness. They're stuck in an endless cycle.
What's Perel's alternative to this dynamic?
She encourages both partners to become explorers together. Instead of, "How could you do this to me?" the question becomes, "What did this mean for both of us?"
Can you give me a concrete example of how this plays out?
I had a couple where the husband had an affair with a younger colleague. Initially, the wife focused on all the details of their meetings, texts, what they did together.
That sounds like the interrogation dynamic you mentioned.
Exactly. But when we shifted to exploration, different questions emerged. The husband realized the affair made him feel young and carefree in a way he hadn't felt in years.
And how did that help the wife?
She started recognizing that they'd both become so focused on responsibilities that they'd lost their sense of playfulness together. The affair wasn't just about her inadequacy.
So the framework helped them see a broader pattern?
Right. They could address the underlying issue rather than just the betrayal itself. Though they still had to work through the betrayal too.
What's another key framework from the book?
Perel talks about three types of affairs. First, there are affairs of transgression, which are about breaking rules and testing boundaries.
What would be an example of a transgressive affair?
Think of someone who's always been the good spouse suddenly having a wild, reckless affair. It's often about rebelling against their own self-imposed constraints.
What are the other two types?
Affairs of longing are about seeking emotional connection that feels missing, and affairs of self-discovery are about exploring aspects of identity that feel suppressed.
How does identifying the type help couples?
It helps them understand what the affair was trying to accomplish. A transgressive affair might signal that someone feels constrained by the relationship's rules.
And an affair of longing?
That might indicate that the couple has lost emotional intimacy. They might need to rebuild their friendship or learn to be more vulnerable with each other.
What about self-discovery affairs?
Those often happen when someone has never fully explored their sexuality or their identity. Maybe they got married young and feel like they missed something crucial.
Let's talk about another framework. What's Perel's approach to the recovery process?
She outlines what she calls the three phases of recovery. First is the crisis phase, where everything is chaos and raw emotion.
How does she suggest couples handle that initial crisis?
She emphasizes that the goal isn't to calm things down too quickly. The crisis contains important information about what both partners need and feel.
That's counterintuitive. Most people want to get past the crisis as fast as possible.
Right. But Perel argues that rushing to forgiveness or moving on prevents couples from learning what the affair revealed about their relationship.
What comes after the crisis phase?
The second phase is what she calls meaning-making. This is where couples explore what the affair meant and what led to it.
How do couples actually do meaning-making?
Perel suggests specific questions. Instead of "how could you," couples ask, "What did the affair give you that you weren't getting?" Or, "What did it allow you to express?"
Those are very different kinds of questions.
They move from accusation to curiosity. The goal is understanding, not necessarily agreement or forgiveness at this stage.
And the third phase?
The third phase is about rebuilding and creating what Perel calls the new relationship. She's very clear that you can't just go back to what you had before.
Why can't couples go back to their previous relationship?
Because the affair revealed that something important was missing or not working. If you just patch things up, you're likely to face the same underlying issues.
What does building a new relationship actually look like?
It means having conversations you never had before. Maybe about desire, about individual needs, about the balance between togetherness and autonomy.
Can you give me a specific example of this rebuilding process?
I worked with a couple where the wife's affair revealed that she felt invisible in the marriage. The husband was a successful lawyer who dominated conversations.
How did they rebuild after that revelation?
They had to completely restructure how they communicated. He learned to ask questions and really listen. She learned to speak up for her needs instead of seeking attention elsewhere.
That sounds like fundamental change.
It was. Perel's point is that affairs often force couples to grow in ways they might never have otherwise. The crisis becomes a catalyst.
Let's get practical. If someone listening has just discovered their partner's affair, what should they do first?
Perel says to resist the urge to make permanent decisions immediately. Don't move out, don't call a lawyer, don't tell everyone you know. Give yourself time to process.
Why is that important?
Because the initial shock creates tunnel vision. You can't see the full picture of what happened or what your options are. Permanent decisions made in crisis often get regretted later.
What about the urge to get all the details?
Perel distinguishes between information that helps healing and information that just feeds obsession. Ask yourself whether knowing something will actually help you move forward.
How can someone tell the difference?
Questions about safety make sense. Did you use protection? Is it over? Questions about sexual details or comparisons usually just create more pain without adding understanding.
What if you're the person who had the affair? What's the first step?
Perel says to resist the urge to minimize or justify. Don't say it didn't mean anything, even if you think that's comforting. It usually makes things worse.
Why does minimizing make things worse?
If it didn't mean anything, then your partner's pain seems disproportionate. It also prevents you from understanding what the affair was really about for you.
What should they say instead?
Something like, "I know this is devastating, and I want to understand what happened as much as you do." It acknowledges the impact and commits to the exploration process.
How long does this recovery process typically take?
Perel says it's usually 18 months to 2 years before couples have a clear sense of whether they can rebuild. But the acute crisis phase is usually a few months.
That's longer than most people expect.
Right. There's pressure to get over it quickly, but Perel argues that rushing the process prevents real healing and understanding from happening.
What are the most common mistakes couples make during recovery?
One big mistake is thinking that the affair is only about the person who strayed. Perel emphasizes that affairs happen in a relational context.
That sounds like blaming the victim.
That's the tricky part. Perel is very clear that responsibility for the affair lies with the person who had it. But understanding why it happened requires looking at both partners' contributions to the relationship dynamic.
Can you clarify that distinction?
Sure. You're not responsible for your partner's affair, but you might be responsible for patterns in the relationship that left both of you vulnerable or disconnected.
What's another common mistake?
Trying to affair-proof the relationship through surveillance and control. Some couples think the solution is complete transparency and constant monitoring.
Why doesn't that work?
Because it treats the symptom rather than the cause. If someone had an affair because they felt constrained, more constraints won't solve the underlying problem.
So what does work for rebuilding trust?
Perel suggests what she calls earned security. The unfaithful partner demonstrates trustworthiness through consistent actions over time, not just words or transparency.
What would earned security look like in practice?
Following through on commitments, being emotionally available, initiating difficult conversations, showing genuine empathy for their partner's pain.
Are there situations where Perel's approach doesn't work?
Yes. If there's ongoing deception, addiction, or abuse, her collaborative approach isn't appropriate. She's clear that both partners need to be committed to honest exploration.
What about serial cheating?
That's more complicated. Perel acknowledges that some people have affairs as a way of avoiding intimacy altogether. Her approach works best when the affair represents a departure from someone's usual behavior.
If you could only implement one idea from this book, what would it be?
I'd say it's shifting from the question, how could you do this to me, to what does this tell us about what we both need?
Why is that question so powerful?
Because it transforms the conversation from accusation to collaboration. Both partners become investigators rather than adversaries.
What about for people who haven't experienced infidelity? Is there a preventive takeaway?
Yes. Regularly ask yourselves what adventures you're having together and individually. Don't let your relationship become purely functional.
What does that look like practically?
Plan experiences that help you see each other differently. Travel somewhere new. Take a class together. Have conversations about topics you never discuss.
Let's talk about the book's strengths and weaknesses. What does Perel do brilliantly?
Her greatest strength is helping people hold complexity. She refuses to reduce infidelity to simple cause and effect or moral categories.
Why is that complexity valuable?
Because real human behavior is complex. When people can't make sense of their experience, they get stuck in shame or confusion. Perel gives them language for their reality.
What else does she do well?
Her case studies are incredibly rich and nuanced. She shows how the same principles play out differently depending on culture, personality, and circumstances.
Are there weaknesses in the book?
Some critics argue that she's too permissive about infidelity, that her approach minimizes the genuine trauma that affairs cause.
Do you think that criticism is fair?
I think it misreads her intent. She's very clear about acknowledging pain and trauma, but she also insists that staying stuck in victim narratives doesn't help people heal.
What other limitations do you see?
The book focuses heavily on heterosexual couples in long-term relationships. Some of her insights apply broadly, but the examples are fairly narrow demographically.
How does her work compare to other relationship experts?
Most relationship advice falls into either the affair-proof your marriage camp or the infidelity is unforgivable camp. Perel occupies a unique middle ground.
What's missing from her approach that people might need to seek elsewhere?
She doesn't spend much time on practical communication skills or conflict resolution techniques. Her focus is more on shifting perspectives than building specific behavioral tools.
So someone might need this book plus other resources?
Exactly. This book helps you understand what happened and why, but you might need other resources for learning how to have difficult conversations or rebuild intimacy.
How has this book influenced the field since it came out?
It's definitely shifted therapeutic conversations about infidelity. More therapists are comfortable exploring the meaning of affairs rather than just focusing on the betrayal.
Has it influenced popular culture too?
Yes, I think there's more nuance in how affairs are portrayed in media now. Less pure victim-villain dynamics, more complexity about motivation.
What criticism has the book received over time?
Some feminists argue that her approach can excuse male infidelity by intellectualizing it. Others worry that it places too much burden on betrayed partners to understand their cheating spouse.
How do you respond to those concerns?
I think they're worth taking seriously. The approach requires both partners to be in a place where they can engage with curiosity rather than just pain.
Are there developments in the field that have changed since the book was published?
Technology has made infidelity both easier to conduct and easier to discover. Social media and dating apps create new forms of emotional and sexual connection outside relationships.
Does Perel's framework still apply to digital affairs?
I think so. The same questions about what someone was seeking and what was missing in their primary relationship still apply, whether the affair was physical or digital.
As we wrap up, what's the single most important thing listeners should take from this conversation?
That infidelity, while deeply painful, doesn't have to be the end of the story. It can become information that helps couples understand themselves and each other more deeply.
And for people whose relationships are solid right now?
Don't take your connection for granted. Regularly invest in seeing each other with fresh eyes and creating experiences that remind you why you chose each other.
David, this has been a fascinating and honest conversation about a really challenging topic. Thank you for walking us through Peril's insights.
Thanks, Maya. It's such important work, and I hope people can approach these conversations with both courage and compassion.